Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Genuinely Grace. I'm in a slightly different studio today. It has different space, so the sound may not be quite as good as it usually is. So apologies in advance. And that's a shame because my guest is the fantastic Catherine Gray. Now, I've known Catherine for a long time. Her book, The Unexpected Joy of Being Sober, was so massive for me. It was such a turning point. Just the title alone was just something that I had never considered, that it might be joyful not doing something that I'd been doing for years. So I'm a very big fan of Catherine's. I have interviewed her a few times before for that first book. I've also interviewed her for The Unexpected Joy of Being Single and for The Unexpected Joy of the Ordinary. So we've done a bunch of interviews together, but it's been a while, and I thought it'd be just wonderful to talk about her new book, Sunshine Warm Sober. Just before we get into that, I just want to remind you that there's a few spaces left on our Sober by the Sea retreats, possibly the definitely September the 4th, we've got some space, I think. September 25th, we have a new date. So just go to the website, soberclub.com /events, and have a look if that's something you're interested in. It's all about visioning the new you. It's all about self-care. It's all about what you want for the future. So it's nothing to do with whether you are sober curious or you've been sober for ages. It's about what's next, which is kind of everything I do really is focused on. Let's look at how we create that life that we want to live, underpinned by sobriety, so that we get to do the stuff that we love. And we've had some lovely chats in our Sober Club group this week, just some amazing sort of infectious happiness coming through on that group. It's been really, really amazing how people are starting to notice the difference that all of this makes. One woman was, I think she's only, I don't know, 10 days sober or something, and went to was going to a party, and all the conversation with her friends was around, oh, we need to book a taxi, but there aren't any available because it's late. And suddenly, hold on, I can drive. and the kind of freedom that gives you. So many of us spend so much of our lives trapped. It's literally a trap, the goddamn alcohol trap. I found it actually sad in the week to see the images in the daily press, in the mainstream press, about students who'd got their A-level results. I mean, you know, big congrats and everything. And also, if you didn't get the A-level results you wanted and GCSE results, really, quite frankly, who cares? It's absolutely not the be-all and end-all. Focus on what you love. But anyways, I just found it really sad when I saw some of those pictures of the teenagers in the streets. And in every city, they sort of did a montage of photos from every city, calling it, you know, celebrating great results. And just all these pictures of teenagers being carried into ambulances or lying in the gutter or vomiting, you know, it just, oh my God, how can that be a good night out? How can that actually be celebration? We've so messed things up. We really have, as a society, making alcohol, just giving it this credence of being this just glamorizing it. It's so wrong. Somebody on our Sober Club, actually, I forget who it was, but I'll credit her when I find out. But she was saying that it's interesting, isn't it, how the alcohol industry never show those images. They don't show their those images to promote their products. I should think so too, because actually what their products do to people is pretty awful. And they certainly don't use that in the marketing, you know. And I can't think of another brand where, you know, you would be showing what actually happens to your clients when they buy your products. But actually, we never see that bit, do we? We just see the kind of glamorous image of the cold glass. Anyways, so I've reminded you about the Sober by the Sea events, and I've already said that I'm going to be interviewing Catherine. So let's get on with it. She is just the most incredible writer, the most beautiful human being. The book is called Sunshine Warm Sober: Unexpected Sober Joy That Lasts. Catherine Gray, how fabulous to speak to you after so long.
Oh, it's lovely to talk to you again.
Oh,
I think this is the only time I've been on a podcast. How many times have I been?
Like, I think you've been on, I think this is the third time. Isn't it third or fourth? I know, it's great. Well, I was so determined to get you on one of my very first shows, and I think I did. I think you were number two, although we were in a noisy cafe, if I remember.
Oh, but it was such a joy, that conversation. I remember it well.
Well, I talk a lot about, well, obviously I talk constantly about your book. I really, really do. You know, I think you're the only book that even got a mention in my TED talk. So that's fairly cool.
Oh, wow.
But so obviously the unexpected joy of being sober was an absolutely massive success. And this is the long-awaited sequel, as it were. And the title is just brilliant. So let's start with that then. Tell us where this title came from, Sunshine, Warm, Sober.
Yeah, sure. So it's something that came to me when I was writing the first book, but I didn't fully explore it. I think it was just sort of one line. And it was just that I've grown up laboring under this misapprehension that being sober is a terrible thing. And phrases like stone cold sober and sober as a judge haunted me my entire life. So even though I had... I knew people and I had sober role models. There were people within my family that were long time sober and clearly happy as Larry, like they really were having a lovely life and much happier sober. I really resisted going sober because I felt like it was going to be this stony cold existence. So the whole point of this book is flipping that, you know, it's a riposte against that propaganda, but it's very different to the first book because it's about long-term sobriety, which is I think the first book, if you had to sum it up in an elevator pitch, would be it's about being a sober toddler and an adolescent, because you do feel like you're relearning how to live, especially when you're a very heavy drinker like me. Like how to have relationships, how to dance, how to go to a party, just you're relearning everything without alcohol. And so it does feel a bit like being a toddler and then an adolescent. And this book is about year five and on. So it's more about being a sober grown up, you know, getting into the real nitty gritty and the deep, deep work that I needed to do to sustain long-term sobriety. So sums them up in a nutshell.
Yeah, fantastic. I absolutely love that. That's my whole sort of passion in life is looking at how we can, you know, have the life we want to live, but the underpinned by that sobriety. But it's not the thing you're thinking about every single moment necessarily.
No, I don't feel that way. I'm glad that you said that, because the one day at a time thing, that really did resonate with me, you know, especially in the first 30 days, if not the first 60 days. But then after that, I wanted my sobriety to be about more than that. I wanted it to feel bigger and expansive and like freedom rather than constantly thinking about how I wasn't going to drink. It was more about how I was going to live.
Exactly.
Sober.
What you want to bring in rather than what you're not doing, isn't it?
Exactly, because we didn't drink for so many years. I mean, I started drinking young at 12. When did you start drinking?
I was later, thankfully, otherwise it could have been disastrous. Yeah, mine was quite a bit later, probably 16, 17. So,
later. But you were an angel.
I was. You say you were a retired rec head. So it really was. I mean, just for anyone who doesn't know your story, just give us a brief outline, because you actually did hit a few rock bottoms, didn't you?
Oh yeah, many, like hundreds. I think it's a myth that people have this big one spectacular rock bottom. There's generally so many of them, and they are often imperceptible to the naked eye. They're just a brief moment where you realize that your behavior is not matching your morals, that you've started behaving in ways that you're really not proud of, and it all seems to be linked to alcohol. It all seems to come back to alcohol. So my story, just in brief, is when I was 27, I started really realizing that I was in in hot water with alcohol because I woke up in a prison. Is it prison cell or jail cell? I always get these mixed up.
Prison, jail cell.
I wasn't in prison.
I don't know. I know what you mean anyway. Jail. In custody.
Yeah, in a locked room with bars in Brixton Police Station. The night after a work jolly where the free drinks had been flowing, and free drinks nights were always when I got the most clattered because I just couldn't resist them. And, you know, there was no limit. There was no ceiling of my bank card being refused to stop me drinking. And so I woke up and I'd been arrested for being drunk and disorderly the night before. And anyone would think, oh, that would be your rock bottom. That's when you quit drinking, especially since I'd been hungover and had blackouts for years and years and years before that as well, really since university. University was where the wheels really fell off and my drinking started just sort of careering away. And I decided to learn how to moderate. So for about six years, I attempted every which way to moderate alcohol because I was so scared of letting go of it. It was literally, there's a saying that it has claw marks all over it when you let go of it. And that's how I was, because I did have this notion that sober was going to be terrible and stony and cold and judgy. And I didn't want to live like that.
Yeah.
So it took until 33 and literally hundreds of moments where I completely woke up in a place where I didn't know where I was, or had relations with a man that I just couldn't remember the name of, or had cheated on my partner, or called in sick to work for the second time that month, and, you know, was staring down the barrel of a rap on the knuckles from HR. Just constant. I felt like I was just scrabbling to stay afloat and keep my job and keep my best friend and keep my flat and keep my boyfriend. You know, it just felt like desperately trying to hang on to these things that kept trying to be taken away from me. I saw myself as a victim, and I just didn't see that I was complicit. I was an architect, me and alcohol, of this slow destruction of my life.
Yeah.
But anyway, eventually, age 33, I had enough, and I finally quit. And the rest is history. But that's the summation of the story.
Yeah, I mean, in the book, there's a lot about what alcohol actually does to us. I mean, it's very in-depth, this book. You've got some great experts in there as well. And I noticed that you talk in there about the impact of alcohol on relationships. You mentioned there cheating. You know, it turns perfectly nice people who would otherwise not behave that way. This is the thing that when I look back, it's that thing. It's almost like, you know, in the words of the great Shaggy, that wasn't me.
Exactly.
I didn't do that. Well, I did, clearly, under the influence.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it feels like. Well, it's so I spoke to a neuroscientist for the book who explained it really well, and she just said that it's your morality is banjaxed by alcohol. It's scrambled. And you drop down into parts of the brain that are much more primitive, and they're just governed by these urges to, you know, eat, sleep, fight, take your clothes off, shag, you know, locate fried chicken. Just very, it's almost like regression, and you devolve over the course of a night's drinking, essentially. And so your morals become completely skewered, and you don't behave in a way that you would ever behave sober. And I was very skeptical about this because I fully expected, even though I'd quit drinking, that I would have to struggle with the almost constant infidelity. I was unfaithful to nearly every boyfriend while under the influence. And I didn't expect going sober to completely get rid of that problem, because I thought I'd been taught that it's, you know, it's an emotional problem that you have. It's a character flaw. And of course it is, but it's a character flaw that only happens when you are drinking. So therefore, without that conduit, that doesn't even come out. It just doesn't get a chance to. It's a bit like, we just don't think of alcohol in the same way as we do other drugs. So for instance, if you were taking acid and you thought you could fly, that's not your inbuilt character believing that you can fly. That's the drug making you believe you can fly, if you see what I mean. It's the person plus the alcohol that does the cheating. So if you take the alcohol away, the cheating very frequently just goes away too. So there was this journal of sexual research or something like that, that did this study that showed that 7 in 10 infidelities are under the influence of alcohol. So, I mean, that's massive, isn't it?
My goodness. I mean, quite apart from anything else, you know, you just become so much more kind when you're sober, which kind of covers a lot of it, really, doesn't it? There's so many sections of the book. You know, obviously, we can't go through them all, but I do like the fact that you address head on this question of, you know, the word alcoholic. It's all in the language, isn't it, with this stuff? As your title shows, the language is very important. I mean, for years, what stopped me even thinking about not drinking was this concept that I'm not an alcoholic, so therefore why would I need to stop drinking? And exactly. that holds so many people up. So if we just got shot of that ridiculous language and what it means, you know, life might be easier. So you address that head on, which I'd love to talk about. And also following on from that, the question, is there such a thing as an addictive personality? Because so many of us believe that we have it.
Yeah, absolutely. And sorry, I'm just going to turn my dishwasher off. It's very bossy. It just beeps me until I empty it. I'm thinking of replacing it.
Haven't you got a puppy as well? You've got a puppy, haven't you?
I have, but he's been taken out for a walk.
Oh, okay.
just so that he doesn't like chew the headphones or something. He's very mischievous. So the first one, alcoholic. I think this is a mixed one. I fully respect people who choose to use that word, and that identifier. And I used it myself for the first 4 years. But I've since moved away from it and I don't use it anymore, unless I was in an AA meeting, in which case I would, because it's not that I think that I was less addicted than an alcoholic. It's just that I disagree with that term in general in the wider world, because there's so much research that shows that there's still a stigma attached to it, and that even now in today's supposedly woke society, people who identify as alcoholics and addicts are judged more harshly, even by therapists that treat them, showed one study. If you identify somebody as an addict rather than somebody with a substance use disorder, they're more likely to recommend punitive measures for that person, like jail time rather than, say, community service. So it obviously has a really powerful effect on the perception of the person. And when you think about it, it's very, very odd. We just accept it, but it's the only substance it's the only thing that I can think of where you become your past addictions.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
It's you as an identity. You're an alcoholic.
We don't say
you're
not alcoholic, do we? 30 years after we stopped smoking.
Exactly. So it is very odd, and obviously we know where it came from. It came from the inception of AA in the 1930s, and I am a fan of AA. It helps millions of people, but I think it's slightly strange that we're still hanging on to this language when we know that there's a stigma attached to it, and it does block people from entering recovery, like you just said. I think if I quit in 2013. I think you were around the same time.
But I've only been 3.5 years.
Oh, well, that don't say only.
That's amazing. Enough.
definitely enough. But even 3.5 years ago, it probably was the story that if you quit drinking, then you must be, if you're not drinking at a party, you must be an alcoholic, driving, or pregnant.
Yeah.
I mean, those were the stories we were sold. So I didn't feel like I didn't feel like there was a route to quitting drinking that did not involve calling myself an alcoholic, because I'd seen it play out so many times in films and seen it in the media and seen it through personal experience, whereby that was a necessary part of the process, that you took on that label in order to quit. And if you chose not to take on that label, people would call it you behind your back anyway. So it is something that really puts people off. And probably I would estimate, if I hadn't felt that way, that I had to accept that label and wear it, I think I would have quit sooner. Now, I don't know that for sure. But I remember just sitting there at 1 a.m. so many times Googling, am I an alcoholic? So instead of the question being, would I be happier if I didn't drink? It was, am I an alcoholic? Am I so bad that I have to quit? It wasn't, would I be happier sober? It was, so that is such an important nuance. Because back then, even in 2013, it was like, it was a sentence. It was a life sentence if you had to quit drinking. There was no real narrative out there where people chose to quit drinking and didn't wear a label. That's everywhere.
I mean,
so amazing
work done on that. I mean, that's my absolute thing, that I want everyone to, you know, if somebody says, oh, I'm concerned about my drinking, you know, rather than, oh, why don't you have an alcohol-free day, the answer should be, wow, fantastic, you've got such joy ahead of you.
Good for you.
Tell us about the addictive personality thing then. Does such a thing exist?
Yeah, so it looks like that's a myth. I asked, so for the book, I took loads of these burning questions that are just debated everywhere on comments boards from here to Timbuktu. And they get people very irate and very sure that their answer is the right answer. Things like, you know, like we just discussed, the labels, addict and alcoholic, whether they aid recovery or hinder it. Also, you know, is addiction a disease? Is it hereditary? Things like that. And the addictive personality was one of them. And I already knew, I think I first came across the concept of it being a myth in Annie Grace's This Naked Mind book. And I found that really interesting, because again, it was just something that I'd always been taught. And it was something that was frequently said to me when I quit and you know, said, hey guys, I'm an alcoholic. Everyone was like, oh, well, you must have an addictive personality. So, you know, watch yourself for that exercise or that
sugar.
Sugar or tea, or, you know. So everyone was kind of watching me like a hawk to see what I would cross addict to. And cross addiction is common. But anyway, it is a myth, according to 3 out of 4 of my experts, all of which I asked each of these burning questions to, because I just wanted to know what all of them would say. So 3 out of 4 of them said addictive personality doesn't exist, because what is really interesting is that certain character traits that are opposing to one another predict later addiction. Things like anxiety and introversion, but also extroversion and being impulsive and spontaneous, things like that. So you can see that it would be the rare person that would possess both polarities of those personality traits. So there's obviously not just one singular addictive personality that is later going to go on and be very sticky for addictions. It's just not true.
That's of course not to say that we don't get the munchies for sugar in the early weeks, some of us, and you know, we do start doing other things, but that doesn't mean that that's going to happen forever. I think it's a case of, you know, as you said, I love the way you described the fact that you're a toddler in those early weeks and months. You really are finding your feet. And of course, you're going to have extra time on your hands and not know what to do with yourself. And your chemical, you know, the neurochemicals are all over the shop. So of course, you're going to reach for sugar or whatever. But over time, and that's what's so lovely about, you know, your book, you're throwing this forward in time. So you're being really realistic about how things pan out when you feel just so much more stable. I think that's a word that so often comes up for me. I'm so much more stable than I was.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel safe. That was a key theme in the book, that I finally feel safe within myself and in my relationships and from alcohol. And it's just such a luxurious place to find myself.
Yeah, there's a little section on boundaries, isn't there, which is great.
Yeah, boundaries. Oh my gosh. I don't know what your relationship's been like with boundaries.
Oh, but terrible in the past. Terrible.
Yeah. I literally only learned how to do them about 2 years ago.
I actually thought that setting boundaries meant you were just a really arsy person.
Yeah, me too. I would bitch about people who set boundaries with me. I'd be like, how dare they say no to my unreasonable request? How dare they not reply to my unsolicited email asking them for a favour? But the thing is, it's very common that people who don't have boundaries themselves. So I was very much the type that would pretty much do anything you asked me to do if you asked me to do it. They are the people who expect other people to say yes to everything. Mm. So it's the boundaryless who get irate when we set boundaries with them. Yeah. So I think that's important to remember, to have that compassion, because it's just that they're not there yet and they don't know what boundaries are and they don't know that they're healthy. Yeah. Now, when people say no to me, I literally feel like high-fiving them.
Yes.
Like, nice boundaries. And you can tell when somebody is a healthy, when they've really gone through this process and that they're healthy and secure and in all of this too, because they will respond to your no with, oh my God, absolutely no worries, you know.
Yeah.
Just thought I'd ask, kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know that it's not damaged the relationship and they're not going away to have a bitching session about you because you said no.
Yeah. Totally.
But it's so important in recovery or whatever you call it, in staying sober, I've found, because if you don't set boundaries, you become cannibalized with resentment over time, because your energy and your day and your effort and your work schedule is not your own. You just give it to other people all the time. And so then you don't have enough time for yourself or time to rest or money or, you know, whatever it is that you need, because you're just giving it away all the time.
Yeah.
And obviously give away some of it, give away maybe half of it, you know, but keep enough for yourself.
Well, self-care is just the thing we have to learn, you know. I mean, I had no idea what it meant till I got sober. You know, self-care is like those, you know, rich women that go to spas and lunch the whole time. I had no idea what it meant. For me, my self-care was a glass of wine. So I had no idea what it really meant.
Oh my God, I really identify with that. And I wonder if it's something that the younger generations are just much more au fait with. They've often been parented in a way where a no isn't the worst thing you can say to a parent.
I think that's true.
Yeah, so I was definitely parented in the way that you did not say no to superior, you know, people in your family, and you did not say no to work colleagues either, because I was in a very competitive industry like you. So you just had to say yes to everything to A, get people to like you, continue to like you, and B, get ahead.
Yeah.
And so I just... yeah, carried this one way too far, and it's something that I still struggle with to this day.
In the book as well, you talk about the terrible twins of booze and cocaine. Now, this is something that's never been my experience, despite being in bands and watching everyone around me. I, interestingly enough, was always so terrified of being out of control that I never ever went near a drug. Although, of course, I was boozing, but that was seen as a drug, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. So,
but now I look back, what a ridiculous irony there is there. I mean, I'm glad because God knows I didn't need both. But you know, I kind of looked on at everybody else. But tell us about this, the terrible twins then.
Yeah, I mean, I relate to what you just said because I did take, you know, cocaine, ecstasy, MDMA, obviously weed. You know, I took the lesser, if you want to call them that, drugs. But I only did so maybe 20 times over my lifetime, which sounds maybe sound like a lot to some people, but actually the amount I was going out, the fact that I had probably 4,000 wild nights out and was around lots and lots of people who were doing drugs, I was kind of the same as you. I was a bit scared of drugs and also especially cocaine because the handful of times that I did do it, I think maybe I did it about 9 times, something like that, I felt the hook of addiction gripping in there. And the next time I went out drinking, I wanted it again. And even the next day at work, I wanted it again. I felt that craving for more. And it seemed to be more ferocious than my craving for booze. So then I just never touched cocaine again. But it's very much a very common tandem addiction that people get addicted to alcohol. And then they learn, which I'm really glad I didn't learn, that if you take cocaine, it sharpens you up so that you can drink more.
Oh my God.
So this is how people, so I normally had a natural timber period at around 4 a.m. I generally couldn't drink past 4 a.m. I generally passed out then, which looking back was actually a saving grace. But if you take cocaine, then you can go through to like 7, 8, 9, even through all through the next day. And so if you can imagine what you're doing to your body when you're doing that, because the cocaine apparently sobers you up. So then you can party more. And so people get addicted to the two. It's almost like people often also get addicted to cocaine and Valium because cocaine is like the upper and Valium is the downer. It smooths out the ragged hysteria that you feel the day after you've taken cocaine. And alcohol and cocaine is the same thing. People get used to doing them together. So I interviewed the experts about this. And also cocaine and alcohol make a whole new drug within your system, which is addictive in and of itself. I think it's called cocaethylene or something. But the experts talk about that in the book. And there's also lots of case studies of people who've experienced it because it obviously wasn't really my experience. And I was really fascinated to hear about it.
And is there a lot less of that going down now, do you think? Have we really got a sober revolution?
Well, yeah, I think we definitely do. I mean, if you look at the rates of drinking among millennials, it's 29% not drinking. And then Generation Z, I can't remember the exact figures. I think it's 4 in 10 don't drink. Who are under 23, I think is their age. So that's remarkable. I mean, if at university, because that's where Generation Z's are, we 4 in 10 of us hadn't drank, then I mean, that is unbelievable.
Yeah.
But yeah, obviously people are like, oh, wow, they're just doing drugs instead. But I looked into this, I didn't put it in the book in the end, and it doesn't seem to be the case. Drug use is still prevalent, but it doesn't seem like that's gone up an almighty amount to explain why so many people are going sober.
Yeah.
It just looks like people are not trying to flee their own skin using drugs like cocaine and alcohol anymore. I keep wanting to say alcohol and other drugs, but I'm trying not to.
Because it is a drug. I know.
Yeah, and we've all been coached to say this.
Totally.
But it's not true.
Yeah, absolutely.
It looks like that's not the case, which is heartening news.
Absolutely. Let me just ask you one last thing, because otherwise we will be here for way too long. Back to your puppy and your dishwasher. What I just want to ask about is I constantly mention on the podcast, I find myself saying it all the time, that I am I'm just absolutely thrilled to bits that being sober is a thing for so many years, forever actually. It's not like, you know, a fitness trend or I've chosen to be vegetarian or whatever. It's not like a trend. It's not a fad. It's, you know, people celebrate it every year. You know, Elton John for 29 years or whatever. Marion Keyes just did a big thing about how she was however many years. And I absolutely love that. I love the fact that it's, and it does genuinely get better every year, right? And in a sense, that's what your book, you know, is really showing. And I love that. But what I did find interesting, and I'm so glad you addressed it, is, you know, so you've got in the book, year seven, asking for what we need, you know, the importance of asking for help. That's a big one. And also, sorry, I'm throwing two things in at once here. Your section on unexpected triggers. Mm. Tell us about that, because that's something that, when I was in my, you know, when I got to the end of my sort of first year, I remember thinking, oh, is that it now then? You know, is everything going to be flat now? Nothing else to look forward to. And then another little bit of my voice sort of said, oh, I wonder whether, you know, all those old feelings will come back and I'll just get absolutely complacent.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But yeah, so the first one, asking for what we need, this was something that happened and I didn't realize I was bad at it, just like the boundaries, because I didn't actually realize you were allowed to ask for what you need because I've been taught not to through various ways. But even something as simple as it's funny because people wouldn't think of me as a very shy and retiring person, but I realized that I do go with the flow most of the time, rather than say, actually, no, I need this from this relationship, or I need you to give me X amount of notice if you're going to come and stay for the weekend, or I'm hungry. I need food. Just something as simple as that. I would automatically attempt to be easygoing. But because of that, my relationships, particularly my romantic relationships, when I was even more markedly bad at it, were not giving me what I needed, but I wasn't asking for what I needed. And I had this revelation where I became willing. So I was in a romantic relationship that was in its infancy, that's now long term, where I was willing to sacrifice the relationship if I didn't get what I needed. Whereas before, the retaining of the relationship would have taken precedence over what I needed, if you see what I mean. So hanging on to that person would have been more important to me than getting my own needs met. And suddenly I found myself in a position where the two switched, and I was totally willing to let it go if I didn't get that the things that I needed, which were consistency of contact and, you know, that regularity. Because I'm an anxious attacher and I need that reassurance.
Yeah.
And when I asked for it, I got it.
Yeah. Well, because actually people love to help others, don't they? Because kindness is good for you. And actually most of us want to help others if we can. And by you asking, it gives other people permission to ask too.
Yeah. I mean, nobody's a mind reader. Nobody has developed that sixth sense yet, unless they're a Marvel character. Mm-hmm. So it's something that we expect people to mind read what we need in some sort of telepathic divination. And when they don't, then we can get the hump and just throw in the towel as well. That was also part of my pattern, was just sort of bending over backwards and then, you know, going, oh, enough of this. I've had enough. Bye. Even though I hadn't actually stated what I needed, whether it was a friendship or a relationship or a job or whatever.
Yeah.
So that was a real turning point for me. And then the unexpected triggers, these were things that I did not expect in any way to push my cravings. Mm. And those things were summer.
yeah, because summer's a big one, isn't it?
Yeah, but I only really started to feel this in maybe year four.
Oh, really?
I remember writing
I had that from the beginning.
I don't know why, but I didn't really notice it before. I think because I was overall, you know, I was so delighted to be sober and to be feeling better. And then year four, as you say, sometimes that it settles down. The euphoria settles down and you start just feeling satisfied and content, but not necessarily cock a hoop about being sober all the time, because it's just your new normal. It's just how you live now. And you forget how bad it was before and how much better you feel now. So you settle down and it's the rewards feel less acute, but they are there. They're just inbuilt into your daily life and they've become so normalized that you don't notice them as much anymore. And so it's important to hang on to them. But anyway, so summer, yeah, the conditioning around summer drinking is everywhere. It's Aperol spritzes and Pimm's and Wimbledon and just, you know, it's just cider and beer gardens. It's just something we so strongly associate with summer. And PMT, because it's scientifically proven that you will crave alcohol more. What was the study? I can't remember. But anyway, there's something to do with your hormones and the sensitivity to alcohol and the reward system around it, which means that you drink more at certain parts in your cycle. Think when you're premenstrual, when you basically want to rip everyone's head off or cry at nappy adverts. So I didn't expect that as well. And there was a few others, and I got the readers as well to tell me their top unexpected triggers, which was so interesting. And some of them are hilarious. Mm-hmm. Some of them are shocking and just, yeah, I loved hearing those.
Mm. Well, it's really good to bring that out into the open, isn't it? Because, you know, then we all know, okay, somebody else feels like that. It's not, you don't have to act on it. Okay, so you've had that, you know, thought come in, but you don't have to act on it. We can now look at this from a separated position, I suppose.
Yeah, and just finding out that somebody else feels that way. I remember when I quit smoking, phone calls were my big unexpected trigger because I was so used to smoking while on the phone. And somebody said in the one of the readers said that her big unexpected trigger was kinky big event sex, basically, you know, where you tie each other up and I don't know, wear a catsuit or whatever. Because she's been so used to being buzzed when she did that, then her sex life became quite vanilla because she didn't have the confidence to do that at first. And so it's so interesting to find out what pushes other people, what nudges them, and how they dealt with it.
Catherine, thank you so much. It's just a fabulous book, along with your other amazing books, and I wish you every success, and whatever you're doing next, I wish you a load of success, and you have to come back again.
Definitely. Let's make it
a regular thing.
Catherine, I love this conversation.
It's great. Well, I mean, there are just so many aspects, there's so much more we could have spoken about as well, but you know, we'll do something again at some
definitely.
Point. Sunshine, warm, sober, unexpected, sober joy that lasts. That's a fabulous strapline. Catherine Gray, thank you.
Thank you, Janie. Bye.
Thank you, Catherine. And thank you, too, for the lovely quote you gave me. Catherine gave me the most lovely endorsement for my book, For Happy, Healthy, Sober. And I was just so chuffed to receive that. So thank you again to Catherine and to any of you who've written a little piece for my book, because it really means a lot if you've done a little review for me or you've rated it on Amazon or wherever you've bought it from. Just a few things to tell you about. Obviously, the Sober by the Sea retreats. If you are interested in coaching, then that's something that I am setting up in the future. So drop me a private private message in whether that's coaching for yourself. I'm already offering coaching, very, very limited number of people, but also training for coaches. If that's something that you want to add to your skill set around self-care and self-love and living the life you love, underpinned by the sobriety piece. Coming up in the next few weeks on the Sober Club, on the Alcohol Free Life podcast and within our Sober Club, we've got a couple of really interesting Q&A sessions coming up. One is with a psychologist talking about whether we can choose happiness. Of course, I believe we can. It would be great to get some of the scientific approach to that. And also another really interesting person I've come across, who does a lot of work around setting boundaries. Now, this is something that Catherine was talking about, and something that so many of us are really bad at. We want to please other people all the time, and it feels too scary to set our own boundaries. So we're going to have a guest on the podcast to talk all about setting boundaries as well. If you've got any suggestions of anyone you'd like me to interview, then just let me know. Please, just pop me a message. You know where to find me. I'm pretty much everywhere on social media, at Janie Lee Grace. And obviously, if you want connection, if you want to be around like-minded people, albeit online, then check out the Sober Club. It is small, it is non-judgmental, it is chock full of inspiration about all kinds of things. It's not just the not drinking piece, it's everything else. And so, you know, we do have members who are on day one, of course, and then we have people who are 4.5, 5 years sober. And it's a magical mix, actually. So check it out. It's a small monthly fee, but I don't think you'll regret it. So do have a look, thesoberclub.com. I was going to tell you about, I know what I was going to tell you. If you are listening to this, if you're in the UK and you can get BBC Four, there's a rerun of the Top of the Pops show that I was on. This has nothing to do with sobriety, but just thought I'd tell you. my 5 minutes of fame as a pop star with Cola Boy. They're rerunning our Top of the Pops appearance on tonight as I record this, Friday, Friday the 13th. It's the show from the 4th of the 7th, 1991. So if you're a music fan, you might want to check that out. I'd forgotten, actually, there were some great acts on the show with us: Incognito, Jason Donovan, CNC Music Factory, Kim Mazzell. Yeah, some great bands from that summer of love, 1991, if anyone's old enough to remember that. And you can check me out in my ridiculously short vintage skirt that I couldn't actually move in, otherwise it would have been really dangerous. Anyways, I'll see you same time next week. Make sure you tell your friends about the podcast. Let me know what you've enjoyed about it, and I love getting your feedback. So I'll see you again next time. Next week. See you soon.
Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by The Sober Club. Please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.